British Public Radio. Food and drink.
Hello, my name's Chris Scott and welcome to this week's UK Wine Show. This week we're talking with Hambledon manager and part owner Ian Kellett. Ian brought Hambledon Vineyards, the UK's oldest modern winery, and has since completely dug up and replanted, moving from still to sparkling wine. He and his investors are on a mission to move Hambledon up the wine league table on his way to super premium wines. The position only really held in the UK by Richard Balfour Lynn's Balfour Rosé. We're going to be finding out about this major revolution going on at Hambledon's, about the history of England's first modern winery, their brand building plans, as well as why Ian isn't worried about oversupply, and he gives us some pretty convincing numbers about why we shouldn't worry about oversupply of English wines. But before we get into that, let's have the news with Jane.
Well, the International Wine and Spirit Competition has teamed up with drinks industry charity The Benevolent to introduce a trophy for the English Wine Producer of the Year to be presented this year. This new annual award aims to highlight and recognise the emergence of English wine onto the international stage during the last decade. Chief Executive of The Benevolent, David Cox, explains English wines have really captured people's attention recently, and similarly, The Benevolent is winning hearts and minds with a new approach to helping those in need in our trade. So this is a perfect way, he says, to highlight our respective ambitions. The new trophy was also welcomed by Trade Association English Wine Producers, whose marketing director, Julia Trustam-Eve, said they were delighted The Benevolent was supporting the trophy. She said it's important that English wine producers forge closer bonds with their trade charity.
A trophy for England's top producer? Very nice. I think a trophy for the top wine will also be better in terms of generating a bit of buzz. It'd be fun to see what happens and who wins it. What's the next story, Jane?
Next up, winemakers in the Napa Valley are looking forward to a great 2013 vintage as they enjoy perfect ripening conditions for their harvest. The cooler nights are allowing fruit to maintain acidity through ripening, a hallmark of a great vintage in the Napa Valley. So there was an upbeat mood in California this week. One Napa winemaker said people who love Napa Valley wines will find a lot to love in the 2013 wines. They started harvesting and crushing this week, and across the board, the colour, ripeness and flavours of the grapes are right where they should be. In Sonoma County, Noah Dorrance, winemaker and co-founder of Banshee, said they had harvested everything 3 to 5 weeks earlier than normal. And 90% of the cool climate Sonoma Coast Pinot Noir was in tanks by early September. She went on to say that the quality had been amazing so far, with superb flavour development at relatively low sugars.
Wineries in the Northern Hemisphere are in the middle of the harvest now, and this is the point where the entire year can be ruined by a freak hailstorm, or, in the northern parts of Europe and USA, Canada, a freak frost. Bordeaux looks like its volume is going to be down, but I haven't heard much from anywhere else. We'll keep you informed. What's the last story, Jane?
Well, not such great news to end on, as the economic downturn in France and across Europe is blamed for the drop in Lanson volume sales for the first half of 2013. Volume sales for the Champagne dropped by 4.6% for the 6 months up till June, while over the same time frame, champagne industry volume sales fell by just 3%, Lanson said. Despite the declines, Lanson said there's still time to turn things around in 2013. The first half of the year accounts for 50% of fixed costs, they say, but only generates around one third of sales. In this way, the results can't be extrapolated over the full year for 2013. That's all from me this week, but don't forget to visit our website at 3050.co.uk for all these stories.
Cheers, Jane. Champagne's main export market is the UK, and with the economy stuttering and spluttering along, volumes in the UK could be flat. When I say flat, I mean up from last year, but don't forget last year we had the Olympics and the Queen's Jubilee, so good times to celebrate with some bubbles. So even with a bit of growth, I think at the best, UK will be flat if not down. One of the advantages that Champagne has is it's relatively lowish alcohol. It used to be relatively lowish alcohol. The old alcohol levels are creeping up these days. But In the spotlight this week, we're going to be looking at the poll question that we asked a wee while ago. And the question is, should alcoholic units and calories be declared on the front labels of wine? We had 318 results to this poll question, and the answers are, people who wanted just the number of alcohol units was 25%, those who want just the calories was 2%, but those wanting both the alcohol units and calories was 54%, and people who wanted neither on the bottle was 20%. If you add the 2% for just the calories and the 54% for both, that means 56% of the population want calories on the bottle. And that's a massive consumer preference when you consider it will not detract from anything else on the label. When you consider that wines with around 12% alcohol have about 700 calories or the equivalent to a whole meal, it makes you realize that calories are an important health issue. It is certainly something that the wine companies are unlikely to put on unless they think theirs are particularly low. For example, think skinny wines, which is a trend at the moment. These are lower alcohol wines, but they still have lots and lots of sugar in them. But the calories are down because alcohol is a lot more calorific than sugar. Given that the health lobby wants us to consume lower numbers of alcohols and the calories are very tightly correlated to alcohol strength, it may help to provide a counter to the view held by many that the higher the alcohol level, the better. Higher alcohol levels often give wine richness and weight, and some people choose a wine based on alcoholic strength. In addition, many French regions have a superior version of their basic Appellation wines that are simply higher in alcohol by 0.5%, maybe 1%. For example, Appellation Contrôlée Bordeaux versus Appellation Contrôlée Bordeaux Supérieur just has a higher alcohol level. Alcohol is often used as a proxy for ripeness and body when assessing a wine. If the knowledge that these bigger wines will lead to a bigger ewe is communicated, it may be a gentle nudge that the government's nudge units should be looking for. Calculating calorie levels in wines are based predominantly on the sugar and the alcohol in the wine. Both of these numbers are known for all wines and forms part of the technical sheets that are usually associated with the wines as when they're imported. Small independent producers need to know the alcohol levels in wine already for labelling purposes, and given that most white wines and red wines are dry, only a small fraction of these that will need to be tested, although one would hope a competent winemaker would know the sugar levels in their wines anyway. Therefore, I think adding calories is both possible and reasonably cheap to the industry and in line with many of the government's objectives with very little cost to the industry. I believe calories in wine is a more sensible and lower cost approach than, say, minimum pricing, which the government has recently abandoned. For the wine industry, it's a light-handed nudge approach to helping people with their health. So my vote is calories and alcohol, please. Thank you very much. Right, yeah, next up, we've got the interview with Ian Callett. As I said at the top of the show, he's from Hambledon Vineyards, and we're going to be talking to him about England's oldest modern winery that's been in continuous production since it started. And we're going to be finding out a bit about his brand building and some of the numbers behind how big the English wine industry could get.
We're at Hambledon in Hampshire, which is between Winchester and Petersfield, about 6 miles north of the south coast. And we're on the chalk.
Are you on the chalk?
We're on the chalky downs of southern England.
I don't know. I think sometimes maybe that English chalk is a bit overdone a bit. Everybody's like quite excited about being on it. You know, same chalk or similar chalk as Champagne, but there's some nice wines that are being made that aren't on chalk.
I think for the Chardonnay grape, that chalk will prove to be quite characteristic for winemaking. Full stop. For growing vines. Full stop. Chalk has a remarkable set of properties. A cubic meter of chalk will hold 660 liters of water, but it also drains well.
Yeah.
And that's a bit technical and boring, but what it means is the vines will never dehydrate in a hot summer like 2003. So in 2003, the Champagne vineyard was green right the way through, whereas if you went to Bordeaux, you had seriously difficult problems.
Yep.
So if you're on chalk, your vines are always going to be well enough watered without being overwatered. So that's true for all the vines, but I think for Chardonnay specifically, some of the minerality and some of the classic characteristics we're looking for in Chardonnay base wines for sparkling wine and for Blanc de Blanc in particular, the chalk will show through.
Oh, well, I think it's still quite early days really for that sort of stuff, isn't it? Although maybe
it all remains to be seen, but Côte de Blanc in Champagne, where they grow all their Chardonnay, is about 6 inches of soil at most, and then it's solid bedrock chalk. And that's exactly what we're on in Hambledon in Hampshire.
Is it mainly Chardonnay you've planted?
We've planted about 65% Chardonnay on the estate so far, and then about half the other two varieties, Pinot Meunier and Pinot Noir. It varies a bit by location, so there are some locations that we think are going to be better suited for Pinot Noir, and some for Pinot Meunier, but the body of the vines that we've planted is Chardonnay.
Okay, and do you like Chardonnay, or is...
I think that as a Blanc de Blanc sparkling wine, I think that's what England's going to actually produce best over decades to come. I think it will be the characteristic English wine of the future.
And when did you plant your Chardonnays?
So in 2005, I rather savagely ripped out some of the oldest vines in England and replanted with Chardonnay, Pinot Noir and Pinot Meunier.
I was going to say that because the vines were originally planted in the 50s, weren't they?
Yeah. Yeah, so in 1951, too, Major General Sir Guy Salisbury-Jones planted England's first commercial vineyard, really since the dissolution of the monasteries by Henry VIII. And he was a friend of Odette Paul Roger, so the Paul Roger family sent over their vineyard supervisor to help with the planting. And there's been an association between Hambledon and Paul Roger going back those 50 or 60 years. And when I bought the place in 99, I did a bit of studying of what the strategy should be, and then went back to Hugh Bedderby at Paul Roger for some advice and guidance. He introduced us to our winemaker, who's the former chef de cave of Du Valois. And so we're really trying to take the benefit of Champagne's several hundred years of experience and apply it on the same chalk over here.
Okay. And did you leave any of the original grapes in place?
Sadly not. Well, that's not true. We've probably got about 5 plants left.
Okay. What were they planted?
Back in the 50s, you mean?
Yeah.
So they were planting Sauval Blanc, some Chardonnay and some Pinot Meunier, but a range of varieties, but mostly to make the kinds of still table wines that were consumed in England at the time.
What's that, medium, sweet?
And at the time, yeah, at the time, you know, we're talking the 1950s, so insofar as there was a mass wine market in the UK, which there broadly wasn't, you know, the main brands were the ones we all know of, Blue Nun and Black Tower and all that sort of thing. So that was perceived to be the market that needed to be satisfied. And so the varieties that were planted with a view to trying to sell into that market, which is rather different to looking at the terroir and saying, what can it grow?
Yeah, okay. And so that was all planted. And then when you bought the vineyard in 1990s, you said?
I bought the vineyard in 99. Mm-hmm. There'd been 2 changes of ownership between Guy Salisbury-Jones and me buying it. Mm-hmm. And when I bought it, my predecessor had run down the winemaking at the site in the previous 4 years, but we were still growing vines. So vines have been commercially grown right the way through from 51 to the current day.
Okay, so he wasn't making his own wines?
He wasn't making his own wines, no. And was selling the grape away.
And was it named Hambledon Vineyards back then?
Yeah. So there was a company called Hambledon Vineyards Limited through the 70s and the 80s. There were 10,000 visitors a year to the site in the 1970s. First ever opened day at an English vineyard in 1955, organised by the Red Cross. And we have lovely, lovely photographs going back to those days. And there's a lovely, actually, if you go onto British Pathé, as in Pathé Films, there's a lovely, and type in English vineyard, there's a lovely clip from the 1960s of a harvest with a classically English voiceover of the time. It's very cute. People picking grapes in ties and jackets.
Oh, really? Yeah. Oh, fantastic.
Very, very English.
You know, in the old days, people used to go out to the country for the harvest, didn't they? You know, a lot of people from London as well, a lot of the workers.
Well, I think in the old days, harvests of different crops, that's true. But I think in the old days, there weren't many harvests of vines being had.
Yeah.
When people used to come out from London. So they were picking hops and whatever down in Kent. But they weren't coming out from town to pick grapes very much.
So what got you into the wine trade there, Ian?
So I've been in the food and drink industry for 30 years.
What were you doing before that?
So I was running food companies and then went to the city to work for Kleinwort Benson, one of the investment banks, working on food companies like Nestle and drinks companies like Diageo and the champagne businesses, advising investors where to put their money. Mm-hmm. And then as a bit of a sort of poacher turned gamekeeper, I decided to invest my own money into a vineyard and restoring England's oldest vineyard to a hopefully in the future preeminent position in the centre of the English sparkling wine industry is a sort of core tenet of our strategy, really.
Okay. All right. Well, it's quite nice that it's still going, though, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, we're doing our best.
What wines are you focusing on?
So we intend to have 2 brands, one of which will be called Milldown, and mill down.
Sounds a bit close to mildew.
It does sound close to mildew. Yeah. It's got two L's in it.
Though. Yeah, yeah.
Windmill down is the hill, the house, the plant is the hill that the vines are planted on in front of the house.
Yep.
And so, and there was a windmill behind the house till about 100 years ago. Mm-hmm. And there's a lovely angled footpath that heads up from the village to the site of the former windmill. So you can imagine all these people carrying their sacks of wheat up the hill for milling. So Mill Down will be our second wine. It's an annual vintage release in the way that much of the English sparkling wines are. And under the Mill Down brand, we will probably end up in due course. At the moment, we've got a classic cuvee, but in due course, we will probably end up doing the range of pink sparkling wines and Blanc de Noir.
Yep.
Above Mill Down, we'll have the Hambledon brand. That will be our main brand. And that will be a non-vintage, multi-year blended cuvee.
Mm-hmm.
It's in a non-standard champagne bottle. And really, we're trying to push the product, depending on the quality of the wine that comes through, we're trying to push the product to being England's sort of first prestige cuvee. So the bottle shape is remarkably
similar. As a non-vintage, though. So.
As a non-vintage. And there are some other non-vintage cuvees in non-standard bottle shapes that are, you know, some of the world's most famous. And if you look at the way in which we've designed our brand, then it might resonate.
All I'm going to say is, for someone who opens a lot of wines and has to lug bottles around, non-standard shapes,
yep.
Pain in the ass, to be honest.
Sure, but people manage to sell Krug 500,000 bottles a year, even though it's a pain in the ass.
Yeah.
So you know.
Okay, and it's quite unusual, though. Well, not unusual, but there does seem to be a move where the non-vintages are almost more premium than the vintages, whereas in Champagne it's the other way around. A lot of English producers always produce a vintage, but not many produce a non-vintage, and you're trying to position your non-vintage as more high-end.
So what that means will happen over time is that our non-vintage will periodically, much as the Champagne non-vintages do, will periodically in really good years release a vintage, mm-hmm. whereas what's happening with English sparkling wine is they release a vintage every year.
Yep.
So our Hambledon brand will behave much more like a premium or even super premium champagne brand. Once every 5 or 10 years, when it's really worth doing, we'll release a vintage, but for most of the time it will be a non-vintage wine that's aiming to take out the worst of the peaks and troughs of harvest.
Yep.
By blending across multiple years and with multiple wine making techniques.
Okay. And then the Mill Down will be is that a vintage every year?
It will be a vintage every year in the way that the English sparkling wines classically are.
That is something that does seem to be coming out in England, isn't it? That it is more vintage orientated,
yep.
Even at the entry levels.
Yep.
Whereas in Champagne, it's non-vintage. I've always thought that was more of a just a lack of wine. Really, they weren't holding anything back because they just needed to get out the door. But
I think that there's some truth in that, probably. But obviously, better to speak to them about it rather than us.
Okay. And you're a limited liability company, and you're the
We're
main...
We're a PLC.
PLC, yeah.
We're a PLC. Public limited company. We're not listed,
yeah.
But we do have external shareholders. We've got 42 shareholders.
Mm-hmm.
We have something over 60% of the shares. And we have some very supportive shareholders who, when you think about it, have put money into this business without it selling anything for the first 3 or 4 years.
Yeah.
So they're really... Some of them are backing it with their passion, and some of them are backing it with their brains, and we hope to deliver well for both of them financially and in terms of the quality of wine that we make, so they can be proud of it, really.
Yeah, 2012 was always going to be a crunch year for English wine, because it must have been about 2008, a lot of vines went in the ground, and 2012 was the year that they were all coming good. And I was never worried because of the Olympics. I thought, you know, that'll be fine, but there doesn't seem to be too many problems with it. You know, the main thing I've seen recently is English wine producers, the trade body, was at Pro Wine this year, trying to dig up some exports. But it's there doesn't seem to be an oversupply of wines at the moment.
So the world sparkling wine market is about 2.3 billion bottles. Champagne makes about 335 million of them. England currently makes, pick a number, 2 million. And when all that vine that's planted comes through, it might be making, nobody really knows, but say 5 million out of 2.3 billion. I really don't understand what the panic's all about. And the UK market's 100 million bottles for sparkling wine and been growing at 10% compound for 20 years. That's not to say every year is a 10% year, but that's the average. And so if England is genuinely making already the second best quality in aggregate of sparkling wine in the world, which a lot of people in the room today would accept as true, and there are those wines who will aspire to do better than second place, behind champagne, then what market share of our own domestic market should we have? Should we have a 10% market share? Should we have a 20% market share? They're not the wrong numbers. So that means we should be doing 10 or 20 million bottles, or maybe 30 or 40 million bottles, especially with future growth in consumption.
Yep.
And that's just for the domestic market.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And there's a 1.8 billion bottle export market to go after, excluding champagne. So to my mind, the worries about overplanting are overplayed. It's about what's really important. If you look at the champagne market, we all see champagnes that are sold at £10 a bottle in Majestic and Sainsbury and wherever, and so we all get terrified about that. But equally, we see wines that are sold at £230 a bottle. So you'll find that we'll end up with exactly the same here. It won't be generic. Everybody's trying to cluster in the £20 a bottle range, and there'll be some that end up falling out, and there'll be 10 quid a bottle, and there'll be some that end up doing really well with their brands and their wine quality, and they're not necessarily the same thing. And they'll be selling for 50, 60, 70, 80 pounds a bottle.
Yeah.
And there'll be a whole range.
Do you think, what sort of investment have you put in? You said you've got external shareholders now to give some funds. Where are you putting that money?
Altogether, over 10 years, starting in, well, over 10 years altogether, we'll have spent anything up to £10 million before we sell a single bottle of wine.
Mm-hmm.
So if people wonder why English sparkling wine is perceived as expensive, you know, you try putting £10 million down for 10 years and not getting a penny back.
Yeah.
So, and I think just to develop that a bit, if you compare that to the cheap champagnes, a lot of those champagnes, you know, it was their granddaddy who planted the vineyard.
Yep.
And it was their granddaddy who built the winery. And that's all, that money's all in the past. And those people just need to pay themselves a reasonable and decent and good living. But they don't need to pay back millions and millions of pounds of investment. Clearly, for England starting a wine industry, it's a remarkably different proposition. There are, and there's probably orders of magnitude, there's probably about £100 million, my guess. I need to think about it a bit more, but between 50 and 100 million, certainly, of capital that's gone into the English wine industry in the last 10 years. And that money needs to, in order to attract that money to go in order to grow the kind of volume that we need to grow to be taken seriously in the world, instead of making a good quality product with a teaspoonful of volume so that nobody in the world can drink it, we know we need to develop a proper industry. And
yep.
That needs capital to be invested, and that needs returns to be generated.
What about non-sparkling wines?
We don't make any.
Yeah, and that was because?
That was because we looked at the climate presently in England, and we looked at the potential alcohol that was typically being generated on grapes that were being grown, and it depends on variety and location. And we concluded that taking a process whereby you had a second fermentation in the bottle in order to boost alcohol level to a reasonably consistent level, plus, if you're investing quite substantial amounts of money to make a reasonably scaled business, you can sell sparkling wines for £20 a bottle, say, and you can still sell still wines for, you know, you pick your number, but a lower number.
Yep.
To me, the maths and the strategy is not hard. But apart from the finances of it, it's also about what do I think this country can best produce. To me, what was really important was when I drank the wines that Hambledon was making before I arrived, I had to form a view of whether I could drink them and whether I could serve them to family and guests in my own home, first and foremost, and then whether I could then sell them. And, you know, maybe that's why I chose to replant to something that I think I am happy drinking myself and giving to my family and friends with pride. Not pride in a nasty way, but pride in a nice, gentle, warm way, and therefore to have confidence selling it out to other people and feeling good about doing it.
Did you completely replant, like rip everything out, or did you graft, or what did you do?
The whole thing.
Just pulled it all out.
We kept five vines.
Five vines. Why the five vines?
Because they were strategically located in a way that it was easy for us to keep them. And also we kept the oldest and largest vine on the site. It has a trunk circumference of probably, I don't know what that is, 30 centimetres, something like that.
15, 20 centimetres diameter.
Yeah, it's a chunky old vine, so we kept that one and probably half a dozen others. But yeah, essentially we replanted the vineyard.
Okay, and that's to go down the sparkling route?
That's to go down the sparkling route. But grapes were grown in the year preceding planting, and then vines were replanted and grown in the following year. So what's important to us is that commercial vine growing has been going on at the site every year since 1951.
Yep. Okay then, Ian. Well, it's good to see that a vineyard is continuing, even if it's now being adapted to modern English winemaking techniques or modern English winemaking. We'll wrap it up there, Ian. Thank you very much.
Very welcome.
Cheers, bud. Hope you enjoyed that interview with Ian. I thought it was so interesting that they were going to pretty much copy the champagne houses. While it may be difficult to taste the difference between champagne and English fields, the marketing has generally been very different. Hambledon, along with Nye Timber, Gusbourne, Chapel Down, Balfour, Ridge and Rathvinny are all well organised and producers of scale and could do very well in the future and set for growth. Perhaps one of my favourite English producers, Camel Valley, are missing from that list because I don't think Bob Lindo and his family are looking to get any bigger. Some producers want to get large, the likes of Camel Valley, quite happy with the size they are. Just to reiterate some of the numbers that Ian gave, because I think they're really interesting. Sparkling wine is 2.3 billion bottle market. Champagne produces around 335 million bottles. In the UK, we consumed 100 million bottles with an average growth rate of 10%. And at the moment, the UK currently produces 2 million bottles, but may get to, say, 5 million bottles. That means in the UK, we'll be looking to produce 2 to 5% of our own consumption, which is a reasonable target. And worldwide, it's less than 1% of the entire worldwide production. I think there'll be a bit more room for English wine in the future. Okay, just to finish up with, we've got a quote. It's from David Orbach. Well, I say David Orbach, a lot of people associate the quote to Ben Franklin, but I don't think it's actually true because Ben Franklin died before the word bacteria was used. Anyway, let's have a listen to the quote, and it is this. In wine, there's wisdom. In beer, there's strength. In water, there's bacteria. Until next week, cheers and good drinking.
British Public Radio. Food and drink.
Hello and welcome to the UK Wine Show. My name's Chris Scott, and on this week's show, we're talking with Richard and Joy Morris. They own the award-winning Anchor Hill Vineyard, and we're going to be talking to them about Welsh vineyards. We're going to find out about all the different producers, all 17 of them, roughly, the key areas in the Vale of Glamorgan and Monmouthshire, as well as Wales as a wine-producing region and the typical grape varieties grown in Wales.
Italian inmates incarcerated on the tiny island of Gorgona planted a vineyard recently and have now produced 2,700 bottles of white wine, a blend of Vermentino and Ansonica grapes. They have been given wine producing tips by the Frescobaldis, one of Italy's oldest and most respected winemaking families, and have even been given the official DOC appellation, or the Denomination d'Origine Controllata, the equivalent of France's AOP. The wine is called Frescobaldi per Gorgona. The inmates grow grapes in a corner of the island, which is barely 2 miles long and lies to the north of Elba, the place where Napoleon was exiled by the British, and Giglio, where Costa Concordia capsized last year. They'll not be allowed to sample the wine themselves, though. Instead, it will go on sales to restaurants and wine bars around Italy, starting from next week. Perhaps the guards might want to double-check what's in those wine barrels before they leave the prison.
While vineyard work is hard work, it is also skilled work. You'll hear about Richard talking about winter pruning, etc. in the interview later on. And I think skilled work is perfect for criminals or people who are doing time because it gives them a skill when they come out. What's the next story, Jane?
Well, as Europe's biggest supplier of wine to China, France is obviously keen to sort out any trade dispute it may have with the country. And the French President, François Hollande, has requested a special EU meeting to forge a common stance on the EU's trade row with China. China announced an anti-dumping and anti-subsidy investigation into EU wine on Wednesday. This is thought to be a tit-for-tat move in retaliation for punitive tariffs imposed on Tuesday by the European Union's Executive Commission on Chinese solar exports to the 27-nation bloc. Accusing China of undercutting market prices with state subsidies, Brussels has slapped an 11.8% higher duty on Chinese solar panels, which will rise to an average of 47.6% in August. While France supported the action, the move was opposed by Germany and a number of other EU member states, which fear for their booming trade with the Asian economic powerhouse.
I'm amazed when I look around the world at the punitive trade barriers that are in place in many countries. India is a classic one, heavy duties on imported wines compared to locally produced wines. I thought that being a member of the World Trade Organization stopped this, but France is in a difficult position. They may be able to justify handouts to their farmers under many guises, but France does subsidize farmers to stay on the land. French wines are cheaper because of it. So France's future wine in China may be in doubt, but their history is becoming more clear. What's the next story, Jane?
Finally this week, archaeologists have found evidence that France's passion for winemaking may have started in the south of France as early as 5th century BC. Items were found in the ancient coastal town of Latara, one of the best preserved Iron Age sites in France, located about 125 kilometres west of Marseille. Chemical analysis of these artefacts revealed that wine was being produced at that time. The study, led by the University of Pennsylvania, found tartaric acid, which occurs in grapes, in all of the jars they found, strong evidence that they once contained wine. The analyses also revealed the characteristic fingerprints of pine resin, as well as herbs such as rosemary and basil, which may have served as flavourings or preservatives, or been added to give the wine medicinal properties. A limestone platform dated to about 425 to 400 BC also carried tartaric acid residues. Archaeologists had once thought it might have been used for pressing olives, but the platform looks remarkably similar to a grape press depicted on a piece of Greek pottery from around the same time. That's all from me this week. Don't forget to check these stories out at our website 3050.co.uk.
Other recent archaeological evidence has shown that France has most likely learnt how to make wine from the Italians. And they learnt from further east, Greece, and they probably learnt by further east as well, as the knowledge of winemaking moved from east to west. At the London International Wine Conference, I attended an interesting presentation by Gert de Verres from KPMG, and he talked about preventing wine fraud. And it just got me thinking about it. Now, counterfeiting is thought to be worth around $663 billion worldwide for all products, with alcohol worth around $1 billion annually, according to a published report by the FBI and Interpol. Counterfeiting has a number of faces. There's counterfeiting, tampering, and brand extensions. Counterfeiting is pretty obvious. It's simply the process of producing a product and pretending it's another. Hardy Rodenstock was considered a master of this, creating fake bottles, including a 1787 Chateau Lafite Bordeaux, supposedly owned by Thomas Jefferson. The bottles, and even the initials of Thomas Jefferson, were from the outset counterfeit, proven later that they were faked when a microscopic analysis of the TJ initials on each bottle proved that they were cut with a modern-day Dremel. Rudy Kerwan, the Indonesian wine collector who in 2007 was thought to be the owner of arguably the greatest cellar on earth, is now thought to be a mixture of counterfeiter and tampering. He brought empty bottles from restaurants and refilled them, and it is thought that he even changed the dates on some wines so that they went from being a wine that's not quite worth as much to a wine from a vintage that's worth an awful lot. That said, when he was arrested, he did have a major stockpile of ink and paper used for forgery, so he was probably a bit of both tampering and counterfeiting. Brand extensions is when someone makes a fictitious wine that does not exist, perhaps a Hardy's Nero d'Avola. But brand extensions are less of an issue in wine, although that said, I'm sure there's a number of corkscrews and other wine paraphernalia that sports the name of a famous producer without a licensing agreement in place. If the wine is counterfeit, then both the producer and the drinker miss out. The producer, because they have lost the value of the sale, and there's a chance that the wine will give the brand a poor reputation. But no producer wants to tell the world not to drink its wine because it's a bad forgery. So there's a natural tendency for producers to cover the story up. Also, if you ask an auction house, and I have asked auction houses about forgeries in the past, they will normally tell you there is no problem here, nothing to see, move along. But it's very unlikely that they will tell you a problem, even if there is one, as this will discredit themselves. So I would recommend you never take assurances that forgery is not a problem, because hardly anybody ever says it is. Certainly no one's selling wines anyway. The consumer is also lost because they're drinking something that may not be as good as one hoped. That said, a good forger can and does get away with duplicity more often than not. After all, it's been shown time and time again, a higher price makes a wine taste better, even when compared to the same wine when people think it's cheaper. So you may not be drinking what you think, but at the very least, you'll probably enjoy it more than the £5 bottle of wine that it really is. There are a number of ways of fraud detection, including examining the labels, tracing provenance, and chemical analysis. Many counterfeited bottles use modern paper and ink, so a careful examination of the label, capsule and cork, and even the bottle shape can, to the trained eye, spot a fraud. Auction houses often have huge stocks of photos that they use to compare bottles. The main problem with the older wines is that bottling at the winery or chateau is a relatively new phenomena, with many older wines bottled by the importer or retailer and each with their own label. While it may seem strange, it is possible to tell if a wine was made before 1939 and the exact vintage after 1939. This is because the Americans and everybody else seem to be detonating nuclear bombs in the atmosphere, and that resulted in a change in the atom carbon-14. It's an isotope of carbon. Plants absorb both the carbon-14 and the normal carbon-12, depending on what year they're grown. In fact, it's possible to know the vintage of the wine by looking at the level of carbon-14 in it. The problem with this type of testing, while it's very good for spotting vintage variation, it won't tell you if it's a forgery from another producer, but from that vintage, a lesser wine perhaps. And more importantly, the only way of knowing for sure is by chemical analysis, which means you've got to take the cork out, which means you might as well drink it. The value is gone. Opening the cork up ruins the value of a bottle of wine that you want to keep for investment. But recent forwards have shown that even mainstream, more value-oriented wines have been forged. In the UK, fake Jacob's Creek wines have been seized in off-licenses, with fake bottles appearing identical to the actual Jacob's Creek, apart from a misspelling on the back label. So it's easier to forge a modern wine. Many anti-fraud mechanisms are what they call one-way. That is, a mark is applied to the wine, which is to indicate that it's not a forgery. This may be micro dots on the label, metallic bands that appear in the paper, special papers, etc. The problem is it requires someone who knows what to look for and assumes that the technology cannot be copied, which it eventually can be. You got to think about the arms race involving counterfeiters of £20 banknotes in the Bank of England. Notes are only in circulation for 5 to 10 years, and then you can increase the level of fraud protection, change the pattern, etc. But wines are around for 20 to 50 years plus, and as a result, the likelihood of the technology changing make it easy to forge is going to be more and more likely. One modern way of managing fraud is by two-way communication. The wine has a mark which is communicated back to the producer. An example of being used in a number of products, particularly in medicine, is QR codes that have a unique code per bottle. This is done in a number of areas and can be used by companies to improve fraud protection and identify where in the supply chain it is occurring. Enforcement officers can turn up at a shop and check each wine on the shelves by scanning it and identifying which is valid and destroying the forgeries. QR codes are particularly useful when wines and beverages are sold in one market and illegally imported into another market. This may be because of differential pricing, as happens with luxury goods, or to avoid duty. By giving each bottle a unique QR code, a customer with a smartphone can enter a competition by submitting a QR code, giving the location of where it was purchased. Forged wines will have duplicate QR codes or none at all, so a duplicate QR code tells the brand owner where the forgery was purchased. This can be used to shut down shops selling forged or illegally imported goods. And this two-way communication can also be used for more expensive wines, so a central server can understand and provide the provenance of each wine and its unique QR code. Forgery is a growing problem in the wine trade, and it's of epidemic proportions in some regions of the world. The move to two-way communications about a wine can improve the provenance of the wine and help track down breakdowns in the supply chain. It is being implemented in the EU for medical supplies, and it's only time before some form of two-way communication is common for wine. I thought the presentation I went to was quite interesting about QR codes. I was expecting something slightly different, actually, but I was quite pleased sitting in on it because it lets you think about forgery as, you know, all these marks that are on the wine, they're not really that useful. Two-way communication may be the solution to forgeries going forward. One winery that isn't in the Forger site well at the moment anyway is Anchor Hill Estates. Joy Richard Morris from Anchor Hill Vineyard, right on the Welsh-England border, but definitely in Wales, and we're going to talk a wee bit about Welsh wines. How are you guys?
Yeah, we're fine, thanks.
We were talking a wee bit earlier that you're saying your climate's actually almost continental where you are, but I always think of Wales as, you know, pretty wet, and I presume that's more to the west coast. So, but where... how many producers are there in Wales and where are they located?
Most of the vineyards in Wales are in South Wales. There are six.
Near Cardiff or?
Yeah, the sort of Vale of Glamorgan, which is west of Cardiff. There are quite a few.
Yeah.
There are six in Monmouthshire, which probably says more about our climate than anything else.
Mm-hmm. How many in total in Wales do you think?
We think about 17.
17.
Yeah, but I think there's a couple in Anglesey, in North Wales. I think there's a new one being planted near Wrexham as well. I can't remember the name of the vineyard. There's a very good vineyard in Newtown called Penarth Vineyard. They make some very nice sparkling wine. So the areas really which lend themselves to, from a climate point of view, to growing vines in Wales really is the what we call the border country. Between England and Wales, Monmouthshire and the Vale of Glamorgan. Those are the sort of key growing areas.
Okay. And 17 producers. So not a massive amount. You know, if you think about it, England's got almost as many producers as New Zealand now.
Yeah.
Which is crazy. Although I think New Zealand producers are a bit bigger. What sort of, you guys are what, almost 10 acres here, aren't you?
Yeah, we're 10 acres. I looked at some stats actually for the Welsh government some 2 years ago, and approximately Wales are producing in a good year about 100,000 litres of wine, which is about 2-3% of the whole of the British production. So relatively small compared to England.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And is it mainly consumed locally, or I noticed that you guys export to England. You call it exporting? Yeah. Throw a bottle over the border. But
yeah, they drink it with Coke over there.
do you guys, is it all consumed locally, or as you know, I imagine, you know, people are quite patriotic, you know, even in the UK, that's there's a lot of its internal consumption.
Yes, our biggest market is Wales, for that very reason, you know, people are very patriotic, and the fact that they can buy a decent wine that's made in Wales is very important.
Yeah.
But we get a cross section of people, really. We get a lot of holiday makers. We're in a holiday area.
Tourist area.
So
yeah.
We get a lot of tourists come to the vineyard and take the wine home with them.
Yeah.
To various places. And we are getting more, suppliers in England. So it's the whole of the UK really is our market.
And Richard was saying earlier that you've even got a supplier in Melbourne, Australia, taking a couple of cases.
We have, yes. I don't think it's going to be our major
supplier. just for any Australian listeners, who would they get your wines from in Australia?
It's in Auburn.
Auburn.
In
it
Melbourne.
It is Auburn Cellars, I think. Isn't
Auburn
it?
Cellars, it's, that's right. Auburn Cellars in Melbourne.
Yeah. Big plug for them here.
Yeah. Wayne, yeah, Wayne Liked.
Wayne Liked.
Wayne Liked. So if you're listening, Wayne, keep on selling the wine, buddy.
Another pellet's coming out.
Yeah.
Fantastic, fantastic. In England, there's the English Wine Producers, which is a sort of almost like a marketing board for English wine. And I understand that the reason originally there was no UK wine producers was because Wales had already had their sort of own marketing board when the English Wine Producers was set up. So they said, well, we'll deal with England, you guys deal with Wales then. But you're saying earlier, Richard, that the Welsh marketing board, whatever it's called, doesn't exist anymore.
Yeah, no, I don't even know how long ago that was, but no, it doesn't. Welsh vineyards are in the main part of the Southwest Vineyard Association, which is obviously also part of the United Kingdom Vineyard Association. We haven't got our own representative body at the moment. It is being looked at. I think the Welsh government are possibly very keen. They're one of the key areas that they're trying to develop in Wales, apart from tourism, is the food and drinks industry. Mm-hmm. And as part of that, obviously, developing the Welsh wine industry, particularly on the back of, if I can say that, some of the successes we've had in terms of some of the awards we've won, is obviously quite attractive. So we have actually got a meeting of Welsh vineyards towards the end of this month, which is April, to get together and see how we can work together more and have more of a Welsh representation within the UK and also from a worldwide point of view, of course.
Yeah, yeah, and I understand you're actually going to there's the English wine trade tasting in
9th of May
coming up, and yeah. I understand you guys are going to have your wines there as well.
Yeah, we are this year. Yeah, it's the first year we've been.
I've never seen any Welsh wine there in the past.
I think you're probably right. So
keep an eye out for your bottles, which I must admit, particularly your sparkling wine, very nicely designed labels. Who designed that?
A bit of a joint effort, really. Mostly David and me, with some input from Richard.
And a guy called James, who works for Gigantic Designs in London. So
we gave him our ideas, and he put them into the form that you can see. So
nice clean labels. I'm very
pleased with them.
Yeah, your rosé bottle, your sparkling rosé bottle, is a really nice-looking bottle in terms of the colour and the way the label works, because it's quite a clear label. Quite like it, actually. So what are the main grape varieties grown in Wales? Now, you guys are trying Albarino and Triomphe and Chardonnay and Pinot Noir and grubbed up your Sauvignon Blanc. So
I think most of the vineyards are growing some of the older German varieties, Reichensteiner and Dornfelder and some Sauvignon, of course. But they're increasingly, I think, as people develop their vineyards, they are beginning to look to plant the classic Champagne varieties of Pinot Noir and Chardonnay, a little bit of Pinot Meunier as well. We've got some Meunier here. Nice. White Castle, just up the road from us, for example, I know they've planted Pinot.
Is there a move to the sparkling wines? Because in England, everybody's just jumping in on sparkling wines.
Yeah, I think so. I think, if England and Wales are going to get a reputation for producing world-class wines, it's going to be sparkling wines, definitely, because the climate suits. Things like Pinot and Chardonnay are cool climate varieties, and as long as you've got the right little miso climate in the UK, then they will grow very well here.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. In England, a lot of people talk about the Weald, with the chalk soils and all that, although some of the better wines aren't on chalk. Is there chalk here, or is there any particular soils that dominate the area?
Well, we've got a clay loam soil,
okay,
but we have got a lot of limestone, which obviously helps with drainage.
Yep.
And
heat retention
as the stones come to the surface.
Yeah. Clay is quite a nasty one for working vineyards.
So. If you've got too much clay, but we've got a very nice balance. There's a small amount of clay, but it's mainly a loam soil.
Okay, because clay gives a richness to wines often.
Yeah, it does. Yeah, it does give the flavour, as does limestone. It's very similar to the type of soil you've got in Chablis, for example. It's heavier, definitely heavier. But it's that type of you taste our Chardonnay, for example, which is not dissimilar from a slightly oaked Chablis, for example.
Yeah, it's probably doesn't quite have the nose intensity on the nose, but the structure on the mouth, but possibly a bit richer actually on the mouth.
Yeah,
not
in
alcohol, but just in fruit weight.
So
that might be Lees aging, though, quite sure. or Lees work then.
But I think in Wales as well as England, the future is going to be Chardonnay and Pinot Noir, with the emphasis on sparkling wines.
Yep. Is there much planting going on in Wales? Like, you're looking to expand, double in size, but...
Not as far as we know. I think it's still something that a lot of people think, you can't grow vines in Wales.
Yeah.
And obviously, it is very site-specific. So I think it'll be a more limited planting in Wales than in England. But
I think that might develop. The Welsh government are interested in seeing how it could be developed. And actually, you know, Pinot Noir, for example, where a good quality Pinot, you can get up to £3,000 a ton. And if you're getting a yield of 2-3 tons an acre in a really good year, as a diversified cash crop for farmers, as long as on the right sort of slopes, right sort of mesoclimate, which I keep on going on about, I think there are some very interesting opportunities, actually. So it's something I think that will develop, but it's going to take a few years to educate and research, I think. Mm-hmm.
Mm. Richard, you went to Plumpton along with David.
Yeah. Not at the same time, but
No. Is there any viticultural courses that you can do in Wales, or is everything done through Plumpton?
It's all done through Plumpton, yeah. Plumpton is the leading viticulture and enology school in the UK, yeah.
Yeah. Is there any others? I only know Plumpton.
Yeah, I think Cirencester Agricultural College do some sort of...
They do a wine marketing.
Yeah, it's course. More on the sort of marketing side. And marketing side. Yeah. So no, there isn't really. It is the place to go, yeah.
Okay. So you've got to still get out to England occasionally. Yeah. How do you feel about paying the toll back and forth?
Well, at least we pay to come home.
Yes.
I was actually thinking about this, it's like, you don't really want to pay, have a fee to leave the country. You want to pay to get in, you know? It's like,
yeah,
that sends the right signal.
They've got it the right way around, the government, I think. Yeah.
Yeah, I was wondering why you didn't. Where does that money go? Does it go to Wales or does it go to the English government?
From the bridge.
I think it goes to the owner of the bridge.
Oh, is it private bridge?
It's a private bridge. The old Severn Bridge is a private bridge, and I think the new one is as well. So I think the government, to my knowledge, can control how they increase the tolls. You know, there's a certain agreement, but yeah.
And at the moment, you're getting your grapes made in Three Choirs. Does that mean it can't be called Welsh wine, or because
no, you can still call it Welsh wine.
Even though it's been made in another country.
Even though it's been made in another country, yeah. But you know, when we've got our winery, Touchwood, then you know, as David said earlier, we'll be able to make the wine biodynamically as well, and using concrete and wood and oak rather than stainless steel, and longer ferments and more natural ferments, and so it'll be a different style of wine. So. Mm. And we'll have the control on how we make it, of course.
What about some of the changes with regards to, I suppose the old word was appellation, but these days it's more PDOs and, is it PDOs and
PGIs? You know, Welsh wine has got to follow the same process because it's part, we're part of the UKVA. From a personal point of view, I think it's over bureaucratic, hasn't always been well thought out, and largely unnecessary in my view. But rules are rules, and we're part of the EU, and that's the world we live in.
So your wines don't say PGI on the bottle, or not that I noticed anyway.
Not the ones you've seen at the moment, because all the wines you've drunk today have been 2009, 2010, and 2011. But moving forward, our labelling is going to have to adjust to the new regulations.
And how does that apply? How do the regulations apply to you?
Just in terms of what you put on the legal requirements of what you put on the label.
And which are?
For example, depending on whether it's a PDO or a PGI, it's what you can call it, whether you can refer to the, whether you can call it a Cornish wine or a Welsh wine, for example, whether you call it a quality wine. And there's certain wordings that you've got to use depending on whether you're making a table wine or whether you're making a regional wine or a quality wine.
Yeah.
I'm not 100% au fait with the rules at the moment because I haven't actually had to address that. Yep. And we'll be getting advice through the Wine Standards Board, for example, exactly giving examples of what you've got to put on your label and everything. And we'll have to make our decision at that time on what category of wine we're going to go for, whether it's PDO or PGI.
What's PDO and PGI stand for again?
PGI is Product Grid Geographical Indicator, and PDO is Product Denomination of Origin, I think.
Yeah, so PDO is like the Appellations, and PGI is what more like Van der Pays.
And you can still make a table wine, of course, and avoid being in that category. So what you put on the label is more relaxed. So it's a choice we're going to have to look at, really. But it basically just means more wording on the label. So the label, the legal label, just gets a bit more cluttered.
on the back label.
Yeah, we use the back label as the legal label. There's no legislation on whether it's got to be the main front label or the back label.
Yeah.
But whether it helps the public decide more discerningly on what they're drinking, I doubt it very much.
I don't think it does. I think it makes it more confusing for people.
Yeah.
You know, because...
Well, I, to be honest, I'm in the wine trade and I'm a bit confused by it all, so...
It almost makes it that you've got to know, have a certain amount of knowledge before you know what you're buying, and I think that's really not a good thing.
I think it's just jobs for the boys, civil servants in Brussels and elsewhere who need something to do, and this is one of the targets, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. Although, there's nothing wrong with harmonisation. You know, I think that there is advantages. No.
Yeah.
And the systems were, each European country had their own system, so.
Yeah. Yeah. You
know, that might make things a bit more easier.
Maybe. Yeah.
Maybe.
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 do the French ever follow EU laws? Sorry, that's a bit controversial, perhaps.
Yeah, 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 yeah.
I'm just thinking about, you know, when you go and buy cheese from a nice little shop in France and, you know, does it come straight out of the fridge? No, it's been sitting outside for 3 hours maturing, and that's why it tastes nicer. But strictly speaking, you're not allowed to do it.
Okay. You sell Welsh cheese here, don't you?
We don't sell cheese, but we do Welsh cheese platter lunches.
Yeah.
So, there are some very, very good Welsh cheeses around. So, as we're a Welsh producer, we decided to use Welsh
produce. Have you looked at matching your wines to the cheeses? Do you match the wines to the cheeses?
Yes. Obviously, some of the wines go better with some of the cheese than others. And whoever comes for lunch is, you know, they choose which wine they want. Mm-hmm. So the sparklings aren't as good a match with the cheese. But if you like sparkling wine and that's what you want, then that's what you have.
Yeah, so I'm very much of the 80% of food goes with 80% of wine. And 10% is fantastic, 10% is a disaster. So as long as you can avoid the disasters, you're pretty safe. We were talking earlier about you guys expanding and looking for new vineyard sites. Do you see yourself growing continuously, or is there a natural size you want to get to? Or
yeah, the natural size is sort of 18 to 20 acres. We feel we've got spare capacity at the moment. There's David and myself who run the vineyard, and we've got Carolyn who works for us full time. Joy spends a lot more time on the cellar door and the selling and marketing, etc. And we feel up to 20 acres, which is doubling the size we've currently got, we can cope with because we've got all the machinery and everything. We feel we can handle more pruning, etc. But we think anything above that, we would start losing control because we feel at the moment we can give every single vine, if you like, individual attention. And biodynamics is a lot more labor intensive. To go beyond 20 acres, you're basically going to have to just start employing more people, and that's just going to erode your margins. So in terms of maximizing margins and maximizing quality, we think 18, 20 acres is about right.
That's an economic limit as opposed to a lifestyle limit, or is it a bit of both?
It's definitely lifestyle limit as well, because we do have a super lifestyle at the moment. But you know, very strongly in economic, financial, to maximize your bottom line. Mm-hmm. It's at 20 acres. We're going to be maximizing our bottom line.
But I think anything more than that, then you lose the ability to keep an eye on the vineyard so that any potential problems are noticed before they develop.
Yeah.
Anything over 20 acres, I think, would be a lot more difficult.
And I think you start getting qualitative issues as well. You know, just take pruning, for example. It doesn't sound very technical, but, you know, pruning correctly is very, very important. So if we went beyond 20 acres, you've got to have more permanent staff. They're only pruning for 3 months a year. Yeah. So what do you do with them for the other 9 months a year? Yet you've got to train them to a very high standard. If three of you can handle 20 acres as well as 10 acres, then you're fine because the three of you have got lots of other work other times of the vineyard.
Yeah, and you're not looking necessarily for seasonal workers coming in.
Not for pruning, no, definitely not for pruning because it's a very specialized technical job.
Joy mentioned the sparkling wines aren't a good match for cheese as other wines. I tend to disagree with her. Goat's cheese is a classic match, but one of my favourites is thinly sliced Parmesan with wines that have got quite a bit of autolysis to them. Yeah, and you can tell the wines that have got autolysis, they're the wines that have got those yeasty, bready notes. And when you develop those yeasty, bready notes, usually the wine's lying on the dead yeast is releasing amino acids and glutamates into the wine, and it's the glutamates slash umami that go really nicely with the glutamates and salt from the Parmesan. Right, just to finish up, and this week's quote is from Dean Martin, and he says, "If you drink, don't drive. Don't even putt." Until next week, cheers and good drinking.
The UK Wine Show is a British Public Radio presentation in association with the wine tasting company 3050. For more, go to 3050.co.uk.